a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
The Judiciary Committee of the Senate will come to order and ask the Secretary to call the roll.
Senators Igalka.
Here.
Hunhoff.
Here.
Valley.
Here.
Here. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Judiciary Committee. As noticed, a brief introductory meeting today. Really, as you in the audience see, we have members to the committee. I think Senator Valley and I are the only two holdovers from this committee from last year. There's other new faces. So I just wanted an opportunity today to invite the players, so to speak, to come and introduce themselves so we have faces belong to who and hopefully do business and efficiently. I have some brief remarks about how I hope this committee will operate later, but I think if we can, let's start with introductions. Let's start with the Honorable Chief Justice, if you would like to address the group and you may interact with the
presentation. Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the committee. Mr. Chairman, my name is Dave Gilbertson, and I am the Chief Justice of the South Dakota Supreme Court. We are one of three branches of state government. You are in the legislative branch, and then, of course, there is the executive branch. As I mentioned yesterday, we are the smallest branch as far as budget. We have about 2% of the budget, but we perform an extremely important function. We actually wear two hats. One is that we are the court of last resort in South Dakota. And in South Dakota, we are one of five states where you have the absolute right to appeal a decision from the trial courts, assuming you lost. Of course, if you won, why would you want to appeal? We handle all the appeals in South Dakota, everything from traffic tickets to the death penalty. There are five justices, and we sit on every case. The other hat we wear, and this is probably more germane to your purpose as a committee, would be we are the administrative head of the judiciary in South Dakota. That is approximately a $34 million budget. We have 40 trial judges, about 12 magistrate judges, and approximately 535 employees. We have a presence in every courthouse in the state, usually based on population and usage. Sioux Falls obviously being the largest and rapid right behind it on the number of resident judges, court service officers who are probation officers, clerks that handle the filing and the records. And so we assist them with services, and we're in a called unified judicial system because we are. We are basically the same in every county, depending on need and personnel. And so we oversee that. I am the Chief Justice. That is probably akin to being the chairman of a board of directors, but policy is set by the court as a whole, all five members. We will be dealing with you on a regular basis because we do have a few bills. I am, in some essence, the 106th legislator. The Chief Justice has the authority under the Constitution to submit bills to the legislature's consideration. The good news for you is I can't speak and I can't vote, but just submit the bill. Generally, these are bills about maybe fine-tuning legal procedures and things like that. There are also some bills that do not originate with us that we will have a position on, if they directly affect the judiciary. The one thing we cannot do for you is give you an opinion on whether a bill is constitutional or not, because we have to settle that down in the courtroom where both sides have their say after a lawsuit. So we are not allowed to give advisory opinions. But we do have an attorney general for that, I believe. I have some of my staff with me. Pat Dugan is the court administrator. She's seated with me. And we also have The two people you probably see the most are staff attorneys Greg Sadazan and Susie Doris. And Nancy Aller deals with probation services. That's what I talked about at length yesterday. And she also deals with the clerk of courts. But as I told you yesterday, we have 5,000 people in this state on probation, felony probation. And we actually have a total of 8,000 if you add the juveniles and misdemeanants. So we are supervising a lot of folks and trying to rehabilitate them without sending them to the penitentiary, as I referred to yesterday, at 20 times the cost of probation. So that is what we do. One of the nice things I would say about being a small state is we're all in the same building. We're going to see each other not only in formal situations like this, but in the hallway and the parking lots. And so we hope to get to know you, work with you, and I guess those would be my comments, Mr. Chairman, if there's any questions.
Any questions or comments from the committee? Senator Hunoff.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, would you explain what Pat's role is? Or Pat?
Could I?
All right, thank you.
The administrative aspects of the court are handled through primarily non-judicial officers, and I'm the head of those people for the state. Our office is downstairs on the first floor, and we comprise the budget unit for the court system, the research unit, the probation office, the publications office, the technology office, the personnel office, and all of the other things that make the court system work. What I have provided for you today is a brief summary in a brochure form about the various services that our office can provide for you in the forms of technical assistance, answering questions, giving you information about the court system. I've also provided to you a brochure about the strategic plan summary for the UJS, the initiatives that we're working on, what our priorities are, and how we're going about achieving them. And a one-page summary, two-sided, that explains the work of the courts in the last year. The annual report of the court system is going to be delivered to your mailbox today, so I didn't bring it up here. But there's more detailed information about the actual work of the courts in this form. We have more specific information at the county level and the circuit court level that'll be available on our website. So that's all available to you as well. And for those of you who are into the history of the courts, we have a publication available in our office, a photographic history that is primarily the work of the Chief Justice, actually, the state unofficial photographer of courthouses. So we have information about the courts as well. Our office is in charge of compiling all of the statistics, analyzing those statistics and reporting them, telling you what they mean to us, seeking the resources for people to do their positions, as well as doing the lobbying for the court system. So you'll be seeing me sometimes, but not as much as you'll be seeing Greg and Susie back there. Do you want some other information?
Any other questions or comments from the committee? Mr. Chief Justice, can you tell me how many circuit judges and magistrates are on staff currently?
Sure. We have 40 circuit judges, 41, we have 12 magistrates, and they are spread out through 7 judicial circuits. They are spread out by population. Sioux Falls is the most, and then what we call the 7th Circuit, which is Rapid City, Custer, Hot Springs has the second most. And there's a map in there that explains that. Most of the circuits have 4 circuit judges, but those, because of caseload, those two, I would call urban circuits, have more. And that the judges are independent constitutional officers. They have to stand for election like you folks do, and although they run on a nonpartisan ballot. And so we don't really exercise total control over them. Like, they are not our employees, and they love to remind me of that.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Nygaard.
Another question. Chief Justice, what is the profile of those 41 judges in terms of age and experience?
Well, that runs a gamut, but I would have to say there are a lot of them that are similar to my experience. They became judges at a young age. In my case, 34. I'm now 61. We have a lot of those folks that are in that age group that have been in the judicial system decades. Judge Jeff Davis, who the chairman knows, has been in the court system, I believe, 37 years. And so we are looking, and I would say probably in the next 5 years or so, at a major transformation of who our judges are. These people will cycle out of the system due to length of service and age. Now, we do have some younger judges that have come on that are very bright, very dedicated, so there will be some continuity, but there is no question that a goodly percentage of our judges are, shall we say, in the fourth quarter of their game.
Awaiting overtime. Senator Nygaard, go ahead.
As you well know, we're facing a lot of cuts. Have been proposed or will be proposed to balance the budget. What would the impact of that be on the justice system, the judges, for example, who have been there long enough to retire, and what would the impact of a change in salary be in terms of their retirement monies?
I guess each person has to look at it individually. I think overall you don't become a judge for the money. You probably could do better elsewhere. But if you have your time in, where that is an option, like a fireman or a policeman, I mean, you obviously might want to look at other options. You could go get another job, and you've served your time. If we were to lose major chunks of our veteran judges, and that includes the entire Supreme Court, and it includes all our presiding judges and a lot of our veteran trial judges, you just don't replace those people overnight with rookies. I think it probably takes 3 to 5 years of experience to be really hitting your stride as a judge, depending on what kind of cases come in front of you, your personality and things like that. And I know you're from Vermilion, Senator. You're going to be losing a very good judge here in June, and the presiding judge, Art Rush. Yeah, he's announced his retirement, and he's going to be tough to replace. He's kind of been the glue down there that's held that circuit together. He's told me he's simply leaving because he wants to try something else. And he's been there a long time, and judges come and judges go, but if you have a hemorrhage out the door, I think that would have a devastating effect.
We do have a lot of longevity in the legal system. Recently there was a highlighted case regarding a commuted sentence, and it was interesting for me to note that the sheriff, the prosecutor, the victim's assistance officer, the judge that were there when that case was prosecuted 20 years ago almost were still there at those same posts. That's pretty impressive, really, when you think about it.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a benefit to society. You take a person, and I know you know him, Judge Jeff Davis, once again, probably the glue that keeps your judicial circuit together. You can't replace that kind of experience, wisdom, and whatever else you want to say about the man. It has been a history in South Dakota. It's a career, I would say. I was 34 years old when I became a judge. I didn't have any gray hair, and I still had hair. I think it's a benefit to the public to have that long-term continuity.
Thank you for your service, and we look forward to working with you and your staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Mr. Attorney General, you're up next if you wish to come forward and introduce your staff and tell us what's going on in the AG's office.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
I think you answered one of my first. 35 is your full-time attorney staff.
It is. Basic, okay. If you look at it, of course, the senator being on appropriations, since a couple of those are stimulus FTEs, and if you count those, it might get 36 or 37, but those are not permanent.
We expect every agency to have one or two hidden employees, so here. Other questions or comments from the committee? Senator Buell.
Thank you. You mentioned the death penalty that we get to make that final decision if we're going to be part of the case. Can I ask your question, Senator?
Yeah. Senator Hunhoff.
Thank you. I have two different ones, but as you were talking about the state's attorney, is there anything through the AG's office that monitors data as to cases that are prosecuted by state's attorney and convictions or anything, or is that all at the local level?
Go ahead.
Some of that data is probably best kept by UJs than by the UJS. We have an annual report that we do. We have some statistics that we will in cooperation with it. So that data is out there, but we don't have a specific process, so to speak, to gather that information.
Thank you. Could I have a second?
Go ahead.
Unrelated, different topic. Coming off of appropriations, we've had over the past 2 years discussion about a medical examiner when Brad Randall retired. What's the status of that now? And I know there were some bills or some discussion about the state developing a position East West River. Where are we at on that?
Go ahead.
When you look at the, just so everybody knows, when you talk about a medical examiner, what we're talking about a couple of areas. We're talking about coroners. Each county has its own coroner. And we're talking about forensic pathologists, the folks that go in and do the autopsy. Traditionally in South Dakota for a long time, we've had, West River had Dr. Hobby that's handled the forensic pathology, and Dr. Brad Randall in really eastern South Dakota, he's located in Sioux Falls, handled what has happened is Brad Randall has reached a time of retirement and is prepared to move on, and so we needed to make some decisions in the state on how we're going to handle that. Right now, the current system with the two forensic pathologists and the 66 coroners cost South Dakota about $700,000. Proposals came up last legislative session about what are we going to do with Dr. Randall retiring, and there was a discussion of having a state medical price tag shifted and was generally talked about, but one of the price tags was having a medical examiner that replaced part of the coroner system and the forensic pathologist was about $2 million. So that was a significant jump of about $1.3 million. Now, those figures were kind of bandied around all over the place, but that's kind of where it came down to. So the proposal that the Attorney General's office was part of last year, and we had bills in front of this committee, was to address some of the coroner concerns. A lot of concerns on how coroners were maybe not handling evidence the best. There was some egregious conduct of using the same body bag more than once for more than one individual, some of those things. So the proposal was really twofold. Number one, we would have coroner training. We could do it here at the state and absorb it without an additional cost to it. So the legislature authorized essentially the Law Enforcement Training Commission to put on coroner training, and we're moving towards that. The other aspect of it that really goes to the medical examiner is we were given the opportunity to really work with the private industry to replace Brad Randall cost effectively. And we've had several meetings on that. Commissioner Ann Hayek, who unfortunately is retiring off of the Minnehaha County Commission, has been working with us. We have gone in a very positive direction with really Sanford stepping up to the plate. We are in the interviewing hiring process to make that happen. There is part of the discussion is for Eastern South Dakota that almost like with county state's attorneys where you have an extraordinary litigation fund that you all join, that the East River counties could join up with Minnehaha County and Sanford and really buy insurance so that they're a part of this pool, and if their county needs to have the autopsy done, it would be done at a fashion. So I know I've gone a long way to answer a question, but I think the coroner training is going in the right direction and will work. The jury's still out on whether or not we're going to need to do something with the state forensic pathologist, but I think it's moving in the right direction and we've got to give it some continued time. My understanding is Dr. Randall is seeing it moving in the right direction and is not abandoning ship and is working with us to get somebody in place before he completely steps aside. The reason Dr. Hobby can't do all of the state's autopsies is basically a forensic pathologist can do about 220 autopsies a year, and we simply need more than that done in South Dakota.
Senator Hunoff, go ahead.
The reason Senator Valley and I serve on rules, and we just went over those corners. Now that you said this, you know, there were some dialogue and some debate that brought up because existing corners don't have to this voluntarily. It's the new ones. My question is, how are you going to evaluate the effectiveness of that training? What that was not discussed at the process, but what's the piece there? So you do the training, but how do you know that I, as a coroner, know what I'm supposed to be doing or doing it correctly?
Well, go ahead. Process will be an examination, and I think the reality is testing in the field, you know, we certainly get the complaints of the Attorney General's office when a coroner drives over evidence and destroys evidence, or a body bag is used more than once, and so I think part of it was simply to see whether or not some of those concerns are stopped, and to really, if those concerns come up, have them addressed within the training. And part of the law enforcement training is we have constantly review the training, not only for the coroners, but review it for the basic training for law enforcement officers, changing the curriculum, so to speak. And that will be an ever-evolving process.
Any other questions or comments from the committee?
Sure.
Senator Nygaard.
And I apologize for having to step out for a moment, but and I may have missed this, but have you commented on your on the cold case unit? I know that Dr. Steve Feimer, a criminologist at the University of South Dakota, has been involved, and there are some cold case work that has been going on for quite some time. Could you talk a little bit about that subject?
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
When you look at the
Valley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one question. You talked about the consumer division, and I think it had six employees, if I remember correctly. But you said you're looking at making that self-sufficient. Excuse me, could you explain how that's going to be? I mean, I can see us getting a big settlement and saying, well, we'll just use that to hire four more new employees and we grow that area, and then all of a sudden we don't get any good judgments, and so now we got to come back to the general fund and say we've been serving these people great and finding all this stuff, but we're out of money now. Could you kind of explain to me how that's going to work to make it self-sufficient? Thank you.
Go ahead.
Of course, appropriations keep your eye on the AG's effort. So that we, you know, we are less dependent upon general funds and dealing with the appropriations process on those important projects. But the answer to your question is, I think we can make it happen in consumer. As long as we divide up the $140,000 operating expenses on the general funds money and all of the salaries on the consumer division funds money, I'm not anticipating asking for any additional FTEs. We're not spending any additional money on those positions. We're just simply shifting it. And you have to understand, when we shift that money away from the consumer general tax, so consumer dollars, those dollars originally went to things like the food bank and peer prescription drug monitoring. There will be certain projects that aren't going to happen with consumer funds money because of this shift. I mean, so, but I think that when you prioritize money and you look at what the state is facing, I think that's a shift that is just simply going to happen.
Thank you.
Just a quick follow-up.
A very quick follow-up, please. Thank you.
My concern was, though, is that if those funds run out and then we got to come back to the general fund and it's a surprise and then what are we going to do? And I think we just need to guard against that happening. That's my only question. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the protection is, and I was very clear to appropriations, this proposal will sustain for 3 to 5 years and then we need to reevaluate it.
Thank you. Any other pressing issues for the Attorney General? Anything else from you, sir?
No, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming this morning. This time I'd like to give an opportunity for any other lobbyists that might be in the room that intend to be working closely with the judiciary, that anybody that wishes to introduce themselves. Good morning.
Good morning, and I'll be quick.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Anyone else? Any other introductions from lobbyists? All right, let's move quickly to other staff. If we could have our interns for this session. Ashley, you can start. Please tell us who you are and how you're going to help. Good morning. Thank you. Welcome. Sir.
My name is Samuel Stroman. I'm from Rapid City, South Dakota. And I attended the University of Arizona down in Tucson. And in order to help, I'll do whatever you guys ask me to.
And you have your sleeves rolled up and ready to go to work already?
That's right.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Welcome. And last but not least, our pages. If you, for this first couple of weeks, if you would identify yourselves, tell us where you're from.
I'm Raquel Hall. I'm from Marin
Theater. Welcome, Raquel. Thank you. Welcome. Okay, just a couple of sort of housekeeping things, and we'll be finished for this morning, I think. First of all, as an overview, as far as the overall goals of what we're going to try to accomplish in this committee, I mean, I think first and foremost, we should all try as hard as we can to give a fair and thorough hearing to the bills that come before us. After all, this is a judiciary committee, and so, you know, sometimes I think you have to stop and take a deep breath and say, why are we really here? And the main point is going to be that we want to have a fair and thorough hearing. Secondly, I think it's incumbent on all of us to do that with the dignity and decorum that's fitting for the Capitol, not because we're important elected officials, but because we're doing the people's work in the Capitol in Pierce, South Dakota, and we need to keep that in mind from time to time as well. I don't expect that we won't be able to do that, but we'll certainly work towards that. Along those lines, you know, I'm going to ask that we direct questions through the chair. That's just a matter of courtesy. Again, it doesn't have anything to do with how important we might be, but it helps to direct and control the conversation a little bit. We'll try to do that with have our witnesses do the same thing. I don't intend to be overly procedural. If you have a question and a follow-up question and maybe another follow-up question, you know, that's probably going to be fine as long as we don't engage in an argument with the witness. So, I mean, feel free. The other thing that I hope we can do most of the time is question witnesses as we go. Sometimes we can get bogged down with that and we're questioning people about something that someone else is going to testify to later. And then, so if we can all keep that in mind, but if there's something that we can ask the witness while they're here rather than calling them back up later. I think that's a practical thing to do and sometimes allows us to answer questions as we go. So we'll see how that works. But I would like to do that when we can. The committee starts at 7:45 a.m. And I know for some of you that means 7:30 and some means 7:40 and some probably mean 7:44 and for some maybe 7:46. And for me it means 7:45. And so I intend to drop the gavel at 7:45. I would hope you'd be up and be here. And I guess if we don't have a quorum when the gavel wraps, then we'll have some discussions in the hallway about trying to get that done. And I know sometimes it may be hard to do that. There may be other factors, but I really want to try to get started on time. I'm going to do my best to organize the committee so that we have about the right number of bills to address each day. We're not just going to pile everything on the calendar and do what we can and then roll it over and roll it over and roll it over. I realize sometimes that'll be necessary. But I'm going to try the best I can as chair to organize and schedule so that we don't have people sitting in the audience that have to come back day after day to testify. I think it's important for our witnesses as well as for us to try to have it well as well organized as we can. I intend from time to time to take breaks, whether we take one or two breaks during our session. I just intend to recess for 5 or 10 minutes, give us all a chance to do whatever we need to do in that 5 or 10 minutes. I think that's will help us keep a better flow. By the way, when we break for 8 minutes, it'll be 8 minutes. And so we need to get back so we can get to work. Just a reminder, I think I was the first violator today, that we need to have our microphones on when we're talking. That means that the green light needs to be bright. I think most of us know that. And if all of you will help me, sometimes we have witnesses that aren't aware of that. And I mean, I think it's as a courtesy to our internet listeners, it's kind of hard to be listening on the internet and hear half or none of the conversation. So let's try to remind each other and remind our witnesses, help me from time to time if you see somebody that's not on the microphone, so that we can have a good record of what's going on here. In regards to motions and procedurally, by the way, I should mention that Senator Cutler, I'm not quite sure what her status is. I know that 2 days ago she was marooned in Atlanta, and she might very well still be there. That is not a very good place to be the last couple of days. Still there till Friday. Well, she should be in rare form by the time she gets here. Then I can imagine spending several days in Atlanta. But Senator Cutler, of course, is a veteran committee chair. I'm very much looking forward to having her as vice chair of the committee. I'm going to rely on her advice for a lot of things. And if we get into some procedural muck between Rubin and Senator Cutler, we should be able to get it sorted out, I think. One comment along those lines, and that is that, and then Rubin and I had a discussion about this in regards to the 41st day, deferring bills to the 41st day. The difference between is deferring to the 41st day and tabling is one simple little difference, and that is that a tabling motion is not debatable. And for that reason, I think in most cases, I would prefer to defer to the 41st day, simply because, especially in cases, I can't imagine having somebody driving here from Elk Point to testify on a bill, and for whatever reason we decide here that that bill is not going anywhere, and that person is sitting in the back of the room, and we have a motion to table, there's no debate, and we table the bill, and they get up and start their drive back to Elk Point. So sometimes maybe tabling motions are appropriate, and when they are, we'll take them. But there's a good reason for a 41st day. It's sort of a softer, gentler way. Probably the fate of the bill is still the same, but at least it allows some explanation and remarks to be made, and hopefully we'll be able to do that when we can. Otherwise, our schedule is already fairly full. We have 11 agency bills. The Attorney General blessed us with, I think, 8 of those, so we can blame him for our work the next week or so. I have scheduled those out. We've got, at least for now, we've got 4 of them scheduled for next Tuesday, another 3 or 4 for Thursday, and then the rest of them for the following Tuesday. And by that time, they'll start coming through the pipeline for legislator bills, and so I'm sure if history is the same, that we'll see plenty of work to do in this committee. But we do have a schedule of bills already for the next 3 sessions. We will plan to meet at 7:45 on Tuesday and start taking up those bills. Any questions, concerns, or comments from anyone else on the committee? I forgot to ask, I guess because they seem such a part of the operation here, to ask our staff at the table here to introduce themselves. Ruben, if you would, and if there happens to be anybody anywhere that doesn't know you, why don't you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Ruben Besplitz. I'm Chief Legal Officer for the South Dakota State Legislature and also Chief of the Research Section. I've been here a long time. Many of you may not know that Judiciary was the first committee other than Appropriations to receive staff from back in the days in the 70s when we were even less burdened with staff than we are down there today. Seen many legislators come and go, and we have a situation which we had in the 70s where there are very few lawyers serving on Judiciary today. For those of you who are lay people, you should understand that that is not a serious impediment to your service on Judiciary. Some of the best Judiciary members have not been troubled with a great deal of law school education, and we'll be getting along just fine. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Rena.
Rena Ortbahn. I've been a secretary for Judiciary and Transportation Committees for several years now, and I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your service. Anything else from the committee? If not, is there a motion to adjourn?
Second.
Motion by Senator Valley, seconded by Senator Nygaard. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? We're adjourned.